Welcome to Unwinding, a podcast that tells the human stories driving the minds and talents of the University of Kansas. In each episode, we sit down with KU researchers in a favorite or familiar setting to chat about what they're working on, why they're passionate about it, why it matters, and what makes them tick as humans. Wherever the location, the conversation explores the fascinations and motivations that produce new discoveries. Unwinding is a collaboration between the Commons at the University of Kansas and KU's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. It's hosted by Emily Ryan, the Director of the Commons, and produced by Mark Sheaves, Assistant Director of Communications for the college, who sometimes asks questions.
Great. So today we're sitting down with Katie Ryan and with Macy Rouse, and I'll ask you both to introduce yourselves. This is Emily Ryan, back again with another episode of Unwinding.
I'm Katie Ryan. I am an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology, as well as a core faculty member in the Kansas African Studies Center and the Center for Global and International Studies, and I'm a faculty fellow in the Honors Program.
And my name is Macy Rouse. I am an undergraduate student on track to graduate this May. I'm pursuing my Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology with a minor in African and African American Studies.
Thank you both for being here. As I was just saying, this is the first time we've had a student as part of one of these interviews, so it's really exciting. Would you, Katie, maybe explain how you first met?
Yeah, I met you in Introduction to Cultural Anthropology,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And this is this giant class, probably at least 100 or 200 students in it. And once in a while, I hear, like, a student who's going to Africa, and I'm like, oh, really? Tell me more. But most students don't major in anthropology, and they go on to nursing school or biology majors, and I don't see or hear from them again. And a year after the class, Macy came back to my office and is talking about moving to anthropology, and she's interested in taking Kiswahili and telling about her experience when she was abroad. And I said, that's so interesting because I'm about to found a lab for students who are interested in doing health and development research in Tanzania, and you are a perfect fit, not just for the major, but also for the lab.
Yeah. That's the co-lab.
Co-lab, yeah. Co-lab.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about what the co-lab is? Because that's sort of a new model on campus, too.
Sure. So co-lab, colon, Bridging East Africa's Digital Health Divides,
right.
started in a conversation with a group of faculty, including Mark Greenberg, who's the director of the School of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures, Elizabeth McGonigal, who's the director of Kansas African Studies, and Peter Ojiambo, who is the director of the Kiswahili program here. And we were talking about how students were learning languages, but they really didn't get an opportunity to use the language in the field. And we talked about how important it was if you wanted to do research almost anywhere in the world that you needed these language skills. We knew that students who studied languages, who studied area studies, are eminently employable. We know that you are more likely to get a job and get a better paying job than you would probably if you majored in almost anything but engineering. But you didn't have that hands-on experience to go and use your language to solve problems, to ask questions, to do research. And going to start a research project in East Africa is really hard. You need networks, you need contacts. And we thought a humanities-based lab that is a group of students and faculty mentors who were all committed to various aspects of questions related to health and development, we could work together to do research differently.
Mm-hmm.
And typically the model in anthropology is when you're ready to do research, you book a ticket and you drop into a place and your advisor says, good luck out there. and you just kind of have to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our goal was to try to do a very different model to allow students to get started with research with their peers and with their mentors alongside of them, using their language skills, getting those professional development skills along the way, and asking questions that you just don't think to ask when you're in a classroom. That's kind of the model.
Cool. I mean, hearing you talk about that and having known you a little bit, interacted on various projects, I know you're an incredibly inspiring professor.
Thanks.
And very passionate about what you do. I wondered whether for Macy that was something that sort of caught your eye when you took that first class. Was it, you know, what was it about that class that really sort of drew you towards anthropology and this kind of work that you're doing now?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think Katie has a natural draw and a passion for anthropology. And when I first took the class, I remember immediately thinking, oh my gosh, I want to be here. I want to do this. But had some doubt because being an anthropologist is hard. And a lot of the times people feel the need to go into certain fields, like in my case, pre-nursing, education, or pre-med, without looking into the other humanities that are available. And so eventually when I was able to meet with Katie, I was really excited because our interests seemed to align and we seemed to work really well together. And so I'm very lucky to call her my mentor alongside a few other faculty mentor. And it's been really great working with her.
Yeah.
Cool. And I'm glad that you mentioned that. And I think that helps us to better understand the structure of what your working relationship is, because we're thinking a little bit beyond the university in terms of who will hear this podcast.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that's maybe not obvious outside of the university is that in different disciplines, the lab model looks different. And so like often in natural sciences, there is a lab structure similar to what you're discussing, but within the humanities or social sciences, that's not always the case. And so what we're hearing about now, of course, as you're sharing, is the benefit to having more than one generation of scholar working together and learning from each other and sharing in these experiences. And that's really helpful to understand. But it's also kind of like, well, yeah, I'm glad that this model can be applied and used. And so that's great that you're sort of testing the grounds of it.
And you have graduate students as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did you find that when you were working in this lab environment, you're learning from them too? Is that like a helpful relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, over the summer, we formed Rafiki groups, and Rafiki means friend in Swahili. And we met outside
from Lion King.
Yeah, exactly, from Lion King. You learn a lot of Swahili from Lion King, actually. And we met outside of our pro seminar time, and were able to talk with some graduate students, PhD students, as well as other undergraduate students like myself, about traveling abroad, doing research, some of our concerns, as some of the students had never been outside of the country, and general field work experience. And so I didn't just learn from my faculty mentors, but my student mentors as well.
And this all fits into a larger field of research called ethnographic research,
right?
Katie, could you talk to us about what that means exactly?
Sure. Okay, so ethnographic research is a kind of qualitative research, but it's a little bit different than just conducting an interview like this or a focus group with a group like this. It means you go somewhere for a long period of time, you immerse yourselves in the lives of a community, and this could be a local community of farmers or it could be a community of physicists, right? It doesn't matter what the community is so much as you participate, you observe, you spend a lot of time getting to know both people and what they care about. You develop a common sense about how people make decisions about their lives, why they act, why they believe what they believe. You develop rapport, trust, relationships with other people. They become more than just your, you know, interviewees, but your friends and, and families. And I think that that's a really, really valuable contribution to the humanities and social sciences, in part because often research can decontextualize people or dehumanize people. We see that a lot in medical research and development. And I think anthropology privileges the stories that people tell. They privilege questions about power and power dynamics and inequality. And we know it because we've seen it, or we've been part of these communities and their negotiations and structures and hardships. And I think that's a very different way of doing research and experiencing the world than other kinds of fields, what they offer in their research methods.
I'm curious about how, I mean, you immerse yourself and you learn and make friends with people in the communities. How do you then share those stories? What are the kind of platforms? Is it academic papers or are there other methods that you found more valuable?
You know, it's funny because even when you're in the field and especially right after you leave the field, and this isn't all social sciences, whether or not you are doing ethnography formally or not, you start to tell the stories of the people you met. You start to tell them to your family, you start to tell them to your classes, you start to tell them to your peers. And there are certain stories that just stick out in your head. And so that first step in doing ethnography is to think reflexively about what stories do you just keep going back to? There was something unresolved in them or something that you just needed to know more about, or they impacted you in a way that others maybe didn't. And then you start repeating them. And now somewhere along the way, those stories become part of academic papers. They become, hopefully, anthropologists, cultural anthropologists especially, write books. And books are really, because you can put as much as you want into them, you can really tell stories in their full richness in a way that short journal articles maybe keep you from being able to do. And so finding ways to share the stories in your field, whether in a podcast or whether in publications, are kind of really clutch. That's probably the much of the point.
Yeah. And that seems like a very accessible way of sharing research as well, telling stories. You know, yeah. Anyone can hear a story. Everyone mm-hmm. wants to hear a story,
yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And you mentioned that this is qualitative research as opposed to quantitative.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the benefits to having these stories, conveying the stories of people as opposed to sort of using the numbers to sort of understand trends and that kind of thing?
One of the first principles in anthropology is that you learn that your own identity or your own experiences shape what you learn from other people. Mm. That science or social science or research isn't a neutral exchange, but rather what you learn is a reflection of who you are. And so part of why our stories, I think, have such impact and are so important is partly we're thinking a lot about how our own positionality shapes what we learn. I think that that makes our findings more accessible, and I think it helps us pay more attention to questions that aren't often captured in quantitative survey-based research about power and power exchanges, right? And if we know who we are and we know that people are excited about what we're doing and they've invited us into their lives and they shared, you know, meals with us and they've shared some of their hardest stories, the experiences with us, they're doing it because they've trusted us, because mm-hmm. we've worked really hard to build that relationship first. And I think that that's maybe lacking in more positivist mm-hmm. driven fields.
Mm-hmm. Sure. You've just been to Tanzania, to Mufindi, Eastern Tanzania, a rural district, and you were immersed in the community for 2 weeks, is
two
that
weeks.
Correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And what was that like? I mean, what stories did you hear from that maybe that would be something you'd want to share or that stick with you until now?
Yeah, so 2 weeks isn't a long time to be in a foreign country and try to do research. However, I realized really quickly that through my language skills, I was able to communicate with people right away and establish that rapport that Katie was talking about that's much needed. And I actually went in with some original research questions that I'd like to continue in the future. But after speaking with people and staying in homestays and participating in the community, such as farming and working at the school, I quickly realized that I had some assumptions within my original research questions. Mm-hmm. And as many professionals in research would attest to, my research questions began to change. And actually, I spoke with some locals that were working with the NGO in the community. And after learning about some of their experiences, completely restructured my research questions. And I think my new research questions offer a different lens in highlighting local voices more so than approaching research from my perspective. And I'm really excited about that, just to be able to establish this sort of relationship in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And you mentioned in another piece we did on the blog that you made it like a close friend.
Yes. So her name is Laurencia, and she works at the local vocational school teaching hotel services classes. And during our lunch breaks, she was often outside with her students who were learning certain hotel service skills like cooking and doing laundry. And so I would go out and chat with her and her students, and we became really close, and we ended up having conversations every lunch about really normal things, but that things that we were curious about each other's culture. I learned about her family, about her friends, about her job, and she learned about mine. And it was really exciting. On the last day, she actually gave me a gift, and I gave her one. And she invited me to come back and stay with her next time I'm in town. So hopefully next time I'm visiting, I will be staying with her.
Cool.
So those are just some of the connections I made. And I know a lot of students had other experiences as well.
Nice. Have you all kept in touch via email? Or,
yeah, actually, yeah. We try and call each other. It gets difficult with the service issues. She called me 3 weeks ago, and then we'll also send messages over WhatsApp.
Cool.
Yeah. Nice.
And do you have a return trip planned? Or
yeah, I actually plan to go back with CoLab next summer.
Okay.
And then hopefully for an extended period of time in graduate school or in a Fulbright application.
And so is this CoLab funded forever? Or is it like a term thing? Or how does it work?
I wish. So we started with a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities that wasn't focused on funding CoLab as we operate per se, but it was a grant to get started with a curriculum for undergraduate students that bridge humanities and non-humanities fields. So one element of this is thinking about a certificate program that focuses on health, languages, and humanities in the world. That's the name, or hopefully. And that means there are dozens of faculty like me who teach courses on culture and health in all of the various dimensions all over campus. And they think about global issues related to health. There are language faculty and philosophers and communication studies and political scientists alike. But we don't really have, at least in the college, a field that captures that breadth of expertise. And so I think a certificate program will allow students who can't afford to jump in with both feet into an anthropology major or another humanities-based major a way of saying, this is important to me, and whether I'm going into nursing school or med school or policy, I've learned a language, and I've thought about how learning a language, learning about a place, and learning about topics in health are fundamental. We started brainstorming what a collaborative experience would look like with that grant, and we immediately turned around and applied for a grant from the Hall Center for the Humanities, who were putting out a call for humanities-based labs. And we didn't know what a lab was. And I met with this amazing person. Her name was Lynn Villafuerte, and she directed, or at the time she was directing, the Initiative for Maximizing Student Development. Basically, it was taking students in the sciences and engineering, and particularly students from underrepresented backgrounds, and getting them into PhD programs in the biomedical sciences. It was largely like lab-based, like biology labs. And we kind of had a conversation about, well, what makes a lab a lab? And thinking about what mentorship looks like, what peer mentorship looks like, how often do labs meet? What do they talk about as a group? What are their goals? How do they work together? And we kind of crafted a vision for how we could bring these elements into a student-focused, especially student-focused project. That got us so far, but to actually carry out a field school in Tanzania is really expensive. That realization occurred right at the same time the college issued calls for its research excellence initiative, called FUN before REF, but REI. And we said, this is perfect. They valued research that put undergraduates and students more broadly at the center instead of at the peripheries. The grant that we won was a collaborative research grant, and it helped us fund the entire field school. And not just funding, giving students a stipend of about $3,000 to go on this trip and bringing faculty members like me on it. I'd never been to East Africa before. But it also allowed us to reach out to collaborators in the field, local collaborators, both alums Jeff Knight and Jenny Peck, who were graduates of KU about 12 years ago or thereabouts, and build a relationship with them who run the NGO or who had run the NGO we worked with. And then a new partner I have, Dr. Oswald Masebo, who met with all of our students, who helped them field questions and ask questions, and start to build a relationship with the University of Dar es Salaam. And he has written both invitation letters to two of our students to apply for Fulbrights to come and affiliate with the University of Dar. And we were recently invited to submit a full grant for a Global Humanities Institute, which is a partnership now between KU University of Dar es Salaam, to focus even more intensely on some research questions that come from this. It's kind of a roundabout story of how research happens, and it feels like sometimes a series of just really, really good luck, but yes, it also came with a lot of hard work.
I was going to say, thank you. Yeah, you should make sure you take some credit for that, because it's also not only the hard work, but also just seeing the potential for these collaborations to happen and staying sort of on the ground and knowing what partners are out there or learning about new work that's being done.
Yeah.
And I guess this sort of brings me to another question about another grant that you've gotten actually just recently from the Mellon Foundation.
Yes.
And this one's in connection with a number of partners on campus,
yes,
right?
Correct.
The Spencer Museum of Art.
The Spencer Museum of Art, Kansas African Studies Center, and the Hall Center for the Humanities, in addition to the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences that's really kind of helped us pave the way for this project. So this grant, it's really interesting. It's called a Sawyer Seminar. And KU had never been invited to apply for one of these, much less had we won one before.
You have to be invited.
You have to be invited. Wow. Yeah. And so it was really exciting to even have the possibility to apply, but also a lot of pressure. And every email exchange I had with the Hall Center for the Humanities, they're like, don't mess this up. We may never get invited again. So
does the invitation come on the heels of all the work you've been doing?
Really, I think it does. I think first, Hall Center for the Humanities is kind of at a corner of a campus. It's out of the way. Many faculty and many students don't even realize what a tremendous asset we have with this center is. They have an incredible endowment and an amazing set of faculty and administrators and folks who really kind of steadfastly work on these very same kinds of questions that we do. And a lot of, for faculty at least, a lot of our like intellectual livelihood comes from having centers like this on campus that give us a sense of community and home. And they also have a really tremendous office to help faculty like me learn how to write grants in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so the Sawyer Seminar came as an invitation to the Hall Center and to the university more broadly. And I think it was a reflection maybe of this work, but more likely just all of the tremendous work that the Hall Center has been doing for years upon years. And they issued a call for all faculty all over campus. If you are interested in this proposal, write a pre-proposal and we'll field them. And I said, what a great opportunity to think about how do we build a community of global health humanities scholars on campus. And so a lot of the thinking work we've been doing had been focused on education, undergraduates, and building a curriculum, but we hadn't really thought a lot about what would bring a group of faculty together to explore this kind of new interdisciplinary field. And many folks on campus, they do this work and they don't even realize that it's part of this larger kind of discipline or interdisciplinary field. And so we started to talk about what our strengths were on campus. Kansas African Studies Center does equally tremendous work on the tiniest budget in galvanizing programming, especially on questions, not just of Africa, but also the African diaspora. And we started to think about, I met with Casey Messick, mm-hmm. the curator for Global Indigenous Art at the Spencer Museum of Art. And we were talking about health topics, especially health topics that affect African descended communities that weren't really getting enough discussion. And often when you think about Africa, you think about AIDS or malaria or, you know, typhoid and cholera. And we aren't talking about chronic illnesses. And more broadly, chronic conditions. And it turns out that that dichotomy between infectious disease and chronic illness is a really problematic one itself. We started to ask questions about things like, how do histories of medical racism, of apartheid, of discrimination, of violence and war, how do these structural factors, and we can bring those right up to the present in terms of economic policy, to the kinds of exchanges that might undercut the ability of medical institutions to treat and cure patients with these conditions. We started to ask about what these would look like. In other words, we started to think about them with our humanities lens on. And you can go into the literature and you'll find gazillions and gazillions of articles from biomedical sciences, epidemiology, and even social scientists. But I think historians, I think philosophers, I think literary scholars, and I think anthropologists have a lot to offer that conversation. We really have a really deep appreciation for those questions. And so this seminar is not a research, it's not like research in the way that we often think about research where you go to the field and gather data. It's going to be, it's kind of like a circus, actually. It's going to bring 8 different speakers, possibly 2 speakers at the same time, to campus over 2019 to 2020 who have broad-ranging interests in the topics I just described. We are going to bring artists and performing artists, creative specialists from different kinds of areas who think about the relationship of chronic health conditions mm-hmm. and people's everyday experiences, bring them. And we're not just bringing them to Lawrence, but we're going to bring them throughout the state of Kansas. So the goal is to build relationships with the medical center, the KUMC, and not just in Kansas City, but also in Wichita and Salina. CASC in particular and Humanities Kansas has done tremendous work bringing programming to even far western Kansas. And I'm really excited to give a public face to these kinds of topics and questions. I think they're topics that aren't just about East Africans, but they're about Kansans. And so this seminar essentially gives us the platform to not just build a scholarly community. It's kind of like, they call it like a pop-up research center. So you have a research center for a year to really do a deep dive in a set of questions. But I think it will go further than just building a research community. It will be about public engagement and sharing these, to go back to stories, sharing these stories to a much wider audiences than we typically reach when we are kind of in our classrooms in Lawrence or in our books that aren't really bought as much as we would like. So,
What kinds of places across the state will you be, like cultural institutions, museums? Like what kinds of places would you be bringing speakers?
I hope we'll be able to reach out to museums. Spencer Museum of Art does an incredible job reaching out to everything from K-12 schools to museums to communities of artists across the state. They have a great and exciting grant right now. I think just came from the Friedman Foundation to bring scholars of art in China to high schools, right? They do a lot of this work already. And I've heard about really exciting programs that the Kansas African Studies Center did focused on highlighting the stories of recent migrants to Kansas, especially in places like Garden City, Wichita. They've led book groups and worked with libraries and really kind of did already this great work in building new communities. And I hope we're just going to piggyback on already their expertise and work with relationships they have already established. So that's kind of the dream.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you had mentioned too, admittedly a lot of these scholars are, their work is based in Africa, but that these long-term effects of sort of legacy problems within society are things that could be certainly applicable in the United States as well, right?
Yeah, in fact, one of the emphases of this grant is to focus, to take a comparative approach. And so as we were starting these questions, I am an Africanist and think about Nigerians an awful lot, but we said, well, what would this look like if we put in dialogue African Americans with African descended people, and this could be African descended people in Brazil or African descended people in Garden City, Kansas, to Africans on the continent. And if we started to think about these histories as interconnected rather than isolated or siloed in these identities, what could we learn? And there are obviously tremendous differences epidemiologically, socially, and so forth among these populations. But what I hope is that we'd show how these political and economic historical processes make people of color more vulnerable to chronic illness and why. And if we can start to understand what makes people vulnerable, then we can also start to think about how we can do a better job in making people healthier, right? So there is a real practical and pressing need to do this kind of work.
Just taking the idea of applying for grants and all the work to do with that, and I was wondering, Macy, you're applying for a Fulbright?
Yes, I just submitted an application at the beginning of October.
Was that your first grant application?
Yes. I had done an undergraduate research proposal, but nothing to this scale. And again, this comes back to mentorship through the CoLab. I was able to have Katie help me out, as well as some other people, Elizabeth McGonigal, look over it. And I think it really, really helped me in the long run, because I'm competing with graduate and PhD students to do research in Tanzania. And so as an undergraduate, you don't often get those skills in grant writing or in research development. But because of my experience in CoLab and my additional mentorship, I feel like I was able to submit a competitive application. So
that
was great.
Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
When do you hear the results of that?
January is the first round, and then they said anywhere from March to June.
Cool. And then you would spend a year?
Nine months in Tanzania.
Very fun.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that something, are you looking to go into graduate school and academic career, or is there another path for you?
Yeah, right now I'm still a little unsure. My first option would obviously be to go to Tanzania for a while, whether that be through Fulbright or another opportunity. I would really like to try and become fluent in Kiswahili. And since I would like to eventually work in East Africa or continue to do research in East Africa, establish some roots there, I will eventually go to graduate school. But right now, I think I would like to apply some of the skills I've learned in some real context in order to give my graduate studies some more grounded experience.
Sure. Do you speak Kiswahili?
None whatsoever. The students were teaching me the entire time. Actually, the community members were really, like, taking me aside and saying, you know, these students, they're really good. What's wrong with you?
I am really impressed. Like, each spring there's the African Studies Festival, I think, right?
Yeah.
The performances, the number of people. I mean, there's not... beyond Kiswahili, there are even more languages, of course, that are on just display at that event. It's just so...
You know, what most people don't realize, because we are, like, in the middle of Kansas, KU has a top 10 African Studies center in the country. We are in the same small group of schools like Harvard and UNC and Michigan State. And these are schools with exponentially more resources than we have and all kinds of things. And we are one of the very best places for African studies, to study African studies, to be an African scholar in the country. And where you see that best is in our languages program, right? So we don't just teach Kiswahili here. We have Wolof, we have Arabic, we are going to have Somali, right? And until recently, they had Hausa, which is the language I learned. Oh. And what that does is, and we have as a result of, and this, we just got the news, we had a, and I can't take credit for this, we can give that credit to Elizabeth McGonigal, the director, they just had a $2 million grant from the Department of Education, and it's a renewal of support they've had in the past to fund a foreign language and area studies fellowship program, and that gives students like Macy, in fact, Macy has one, a full tuition scholarship, or nearly a full tuition scholarship and a stipend, so that they can concentrate on language and area studies in their expertise.
Cool.
And they can start that as undergraduates. It also funds graduate students. And when you have that platform or that foundation, that's where you can start to build from there into research experiences like hours. And so, I mean, I know that's like kind of shocking for some students to realize, but full scholarships to study African languages here, and you don't have to just be the anthropologist or be the African American studies scholar. We have engineers who have received FLESS awards before. So it's about building the capacity for doing African studies research and building professionals that have the language skills that they need to do that kind of work. And language is really fundamental, whether you're in business or law or engineering, right?
Mm-hmm. So I have one last question, maybe for both of you, noting that you're involved in so many things beyond what you could do as a minimum for each of your roles as a student and as a faculty member. And the question is just, how do you balance and prioritize with the number of things that you have going on all the time?
As well as your own personal life.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Let's not forget that you are human on top of all this too, so...
I take time to enjoy my hobbies, and one of those is dance. I grew up dancing my whole life. In fact, I'm a dance teacher now. And so while that is a job for me, it's still a chance for me to kind of get away from this academic life and go in a space that I can create and share my passions with other people who are in the dance world. And so that's been a really important part of my life and balancing my academic career, my personal life, as well as the other activities I'm involved with on campus.
That's cool. We should have filmed this in a dance studio.
Yeah.
Macy does this so much better than I do. I think this is where mentorship needs to work in the opposite direction. I think it's really hard. And I think the difference is when you're really, really passionate and when these projects give you, I mean, they're really who you are and you're really part of your soul. Finding things to do that build you up and make you feel like you're making an impact do a lot to keep you buoyant, even when the, like, drudgery of this work is really hard. And then if you can stay as motivated and as excited, then it makes it easy to carry that into your own personal life. and not let the amount of hours it takes kind of weigh down at you to do the work. And so,
garden, right?
I do. I worked really hard on that garden this summer. I'm also a really loving pet parent of three wonderful cats. I have really great cat videos.
Which, frankly, just makes me have more questions about how they're cared for when you're out of town so often and all that. But
it's not easy.
Anyway, thank you both so much for sitting down and chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you.
I have a much
thank
better you. Understanding of all of the things you're working on now.
It's great to see you two together, like, building this relationship.
Yeah.
It's really
and learning from each other. I mean, the reciprocal kind of,
Thank you.
Thank you.
Unwinding is a collaboration between the Commons at KU and KU's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. The Commons is a catalyst for unconventional thinking, interdisciplinary inquiry, and unexpected discoveries across the sciences, arts, and humanities. The College of Liberal Arts and Sciences is the heart of KU. It's home to more than 50 departments, programs, and centers, offering more than 100 majors, minors, and certificates. A collaborative and creative community, the college is committed to making the world better through inquiry and research.